This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you Sunday, the 15th of September on CBC Radio. It was down to the wire, but Air Canada and the union representing its pilots have a tentative deal. First up, we'll explore why this doesn't necessarily mean the end of broader turbulence in the transportation sector. After that, we'll hear why it's bound to be a rough landing for MPs when they return to the House of Commons tomorrow. Then, a trip down the yellow brick road shows how the song Over the Rainbow keeps finding new life 8.5 decades after The Wizard of Oz hit screens. Later on, a surge in population growth is sparking affordability concerns, but are recent changes to Canada's immigration policies the fix we need? Two economists will break down whether it all adds up. And before all's done and dusted, we'll have a proper look at why we're just so keen on turns of phrase from across the pond. It all starts in a jiffy on the Sunday Magazine. If you have a flight booked on Air Canada in the coming days and weeks, you can breathe a sigh of relief. Air Canada and the Airline Pilots Association, which represents Air Canada's 5,200 pilots, have struck a 4-year tentative agreement. And the deal was announced just as a 72-hour countdown clock for a strike or lockout was about to begin. This was the latest labor dispute that has cropped up involving the transportation industry here at home and abroad. John Graddick is a faculty lecturer in aviation management at Montreal's McGill University. John, good morning to you.
Good morning, Pia.
Okay, so that was close, and we'll get into the deal in a minute. But if you're an Air Canada passenger who had a flight booked the next week or so, and then you change your flight because of a potential work stoppage, what are your options at this point?
Oh, I think Air Canada would, in fact, recognize your initial reservation. And depending on the state of sale on that original flight, they'll bring you back to your original flight at no extra charge. Oh. So it all depends if there's space remaining on that original flight.
Right. For some people who've made changes, maybe not out of the woods completely yet in terms of having no turbulence in their travel plans. But let's get to the deal. How surprised are you that there is a tentative deal?
Well, not surprised at all. I think that we knew that negotiations were coming along. And, you know, and I had said there was a chance that there was going to be a strike, because the rhetoric that was going on between Air Canada and the union was pretty strong. You know, I think, you know, when you hear the president of Air Canada saying that, you know, there are unreasonable demands, and that and the pilot union was saying, you know, there has to be recognition by Air Canada that the value of their pilots has changed, and that has to be reflected in a significant pay increase. So I think that the end result was that, you know, both parties kind of scale back the rhetoric just a little bit and came up with a deal.
Hmm. Okay, so the terms of this agreement are being kept under wraps until the union members can have a look at it, and then it'll go to a vote. In a statement, the union said the tentative agreement will, quote, generate an approximate additional $1.9 billion of value for Air Canada pilots over the course of the agreement. So we don't know the details, of course, but what does that generally tell you about what was negotiated between the two sides?
My quick back of the envelope calculation tells me that it's somewhere between 35% and 40%, which is what the pilots got. So that's the back of the envelope. You know, depending on where you're sitting in the rank and file, you know, Air Canada had this introductory rate of pay for their new hire pilots, which to me was an abomination, because you bet pilots are being paid somewhere between $55,000 and $75,000 a year. for the first 4 years, whereas that is really a blue collar wage, which, you know, that didn't make any sense for pilots. So I'm pretty sure that group of pilots got a fairly nice bump in their pay, and that may take a bit of the economic value. But you know, I think that, you know, overall, you know, those junior pilots will get probably a 60 or 70% pay raise, whereas the rest of the group will probably get somewhere around 32-35%.
So I hear what you're saying, but I think some people listening might be saying, people are going to get a 60% pay raise or a 35-40% pay raise. Just put the context around that, but why that might be happening beyond those junior pilots.
Oh, I think that what's going on with the industry is that Air Canada's pilots came off a 10-year contract that they had negotiated back in 2014. That was, you know, kind of an interesting scenario behind that contract, because it came off a similar arbitration deal in 2012, and the Canadian government really put the screws to the to the pilots to basically settle for a long-term contract. I think the government was sick and tired of these work disruptions at the airline and said, let's have some labor peace. And so they negotiated, you know, they forced the airline to go into 10-year contracts, where the pilots had no choice but to go into them as well. And that got, you know, moved over to include the flight attendants and the ground workers. So Air Canada enjoyed a significant amount of labor peace over a 10-year span. The problem was, at the end of that 10-year span, now you have to pay the piper when it comes to what's going on in the economy around you. And was that 2% really warranted? And of course, we find that, you know, the economic conditions around Canada for the last 10 years, people were getting significantly higher than 2% raises. So now there was a catch up that the pilots wanted in terms of the economic value of their contracts and what they've lost for those 10 years. So while those 10 years were great for strike, and for labor peace, they did not do wonders in terms of the economic value that those contracts were giving.
You mentioned flight attendants and ground workers. Are their contracts coming up for renegotiation as well?
Yes, ma'am. The flight attendants, I think, if I remember correctly, their contract expires at the end of 2024. So they were very, very keen in looking at how well their brethren in the pilot group were doing in these negotiations, and they're going to know fairly quickly what the economic package that the pilots got. And guess what? That's going to be the starting point for the flight attendants. And they've got other issues that they have to deal with over and above just pay. I think the flight attendants have been wanting to have Air Canada recognize that the work that the flight attendants are doing prior to a flight, prior to their pay starting, has not been remunerated by Air Canada. And that's one of the key demands of the flight attendants, to recognize that their work day is a lot longer than what they're getting paid for. And I think that's going to be an issue that's going to be addressed in the next contract.
The Prime Minister said, no problem. The Prime Minister said the government would not get involved in the Air Canada dispute, despite Air Canada and some business groups asking for it. But the Liberal government did intervene in the recent railroad strike. In that case, it sent that dispute to the CIRB, the Canada Industrial Relations Board. Where do you see the difference between these in terms of government intervention?
Oh, I think they're very different. I think that, you know, the CIRB, really, you know, the referral to the CIRB was a result of both national carriers going out on a labor dispute at the same time. And that really shut down completely rail traffic and rail movements in Canada. There was no alternative. If the farmers are moving grain to the Port of Vancouver, you're taking containers from the Port of Montreal, all that stuff only moves by rail. And I think that, you know, there was a significant impact to the Canadian economy as a result of that strike. And the government reacted quickly to kind of maintain the supply chain and the integrity of the supply chain, because it really was at risk.
Okay. Given that context, there is also potential for a huge disruption, another one in the transportation industry. This has to do with ports in the United States, the International Longshoremen's Association possibly going out on strike beginning the beginning of October. This is going to affect, if it happens, many ports in the United States. Given that our supply chains are all closely knitted together, what kind of effect could that potential strike have on our country?
It will have an effect. I think that, you know, we've seen last year, I think the U.S. West Coast ports go through a similar type of labor disruption, and we saw movement of freight move either to the ports in Canada or use the Panama Canal to get into the East Coast ports. And that slowed down the whole process. And you had ships waiting weeks on end on the ports in the, on the West Coast to get into port to unload. And so we're going to see the same type of phenomena in the East Coast. That, you know, the industry, the transportation industry has known about this potential strike for quite a few months. So I already think that the industry, the shipping industry, has recognized that there is a potential for this strike. So they have already moved stuff either earlier into the supply chain or have already moved it into other ports on the West Coast or into Canada. So I don't think it's going to be a mess, but I could be wrong. There could be, you know, organizations that may have not planned for this type of strike, but there was enough visibility in the marketplace of this, you know, upcoming labor disruption that hopefully most organizations reacted to it. But this is just another example of disruption in our supply chain. We thought that, you know, come the end of COVID and everything going back to normal economically, that the supply chains are going to be robust and go back to the way it was. And guess what? You know, supply chains are not going back to the way it was. Disruption is going to be part of the continuous review that we have our supply chains.
John, I appreciate you getting up for us this morning. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Pia. Have a great day. Take care.
You too. John Graddick is a faculty lecturer in aviation management at Montreal's McGill University. Well, the deal between Air Canada and the pilots' union will be welcome news by the governing Liberals, and it comes as the House of Commons prepares to return for its fall sitting tomorrow, the same day that two key by-elections will be held. Marika Walsh is the Globe and Mail senior political reporter. Good morning to you, Marika.
Good morning, Pia.
Prime Minister Trudeau denied that request of Air Canada a couple of days back to intervene in the Air Canada dispute, saying the government believes in collective bargaining. Given that, how is this settlement going to play out for Justin Trudeau politically? And how does that statement kind of square with the government stepping in and stopping the rail blockade just a few weeks back?
Mm-hmm. Well, it will be very welcome news because, as you just mentioned, the Prime Minister already has many thorns in his side, and one taken out will be welcome. I think it's important to note just how different the context in the House of Commons is to the second part of your question from what John just described 10, 12 years ago under the Harper government. No party in the House of Commons is really eager to enforce binding arbitration on a union. Pierre Poilievre, who was part of the Harper government 10 years ago, was one of the leaders who came out last week urging a good deal for pilots. So the context in which the government and these companies are operating is very different than we saw a decade ago. And that has really shifted, I think, politically, the upper hand to workers who now see different parties competing for their vote, competing for their support. And because of that, they will see, I think, less intervention or slower intervention. The reason why it was so different with the railways is just because of how massive the railway stoppage was. It was both railways at the same time, effectively, which stopped all rail travel in Canada. That was not the case with the Air Canada pilots. And so Air Canada, the company, could not rely on the same intervention that those railways did.
And so you mentioned the conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, saying last week he sort of stands by the pilots in terms of them mm-hmm. getting a fair deal. To what, like strategically, is that also an attempt to eat into the NDP's traditional labor and union support?
Completely. And it's something that we saw Ontario Premier Doug Ford do very effectively in his most recent election just over 2 years ago. So Pierre Poilievre shares an advisor who used to advise Doug Ford. That's Jenny Byrne. And, you know, you can see the path to victory that the Conservatives are trying to craft for themselves doesn't just eat into Liberal votes in sort of those vast suburban swaths around Vancouver and Toronto and the GTA, but also eats into those ridings outside of those urban cores that aren't sort of NDP Liberal switchers, but are actually blue-orange switchers. And that's where the Conservatives are hoping that their more pro union stance will win them votes in Northern Ontario around Hamilton and also on Vancouver Island, among others. So it is going to, it's a very interesting pivot for the Conservatives. It's a big pivot for them federally, especially compared to the last time they were in federal government, but it's one that they are trying to execute in particular against the NDP.
Okay, we might get a sense tomorrow of how everyone's sort of strategically positioning themselves and making changes, mm-hmm. And also the impact of the death of the NDP Liberal deal, how it's all playing mm-hmm. out. We have these two by-elections, one in Montreal, the other in Manitoba. Just to set it up for our listeners, the Montreal riding is currently held by the Liberals. The Winnipeg seat has been held by the NDP, I think, for almost 40 years, with a little bit of exception by Blakey, the father, and then the son. What's riding on these by-elections for each of the three major parties? And for the Bloc Québécois, of course, in Quebec.
Well, according to some of them, nothing. And according to everybody else, everything. You might have this interesting situation, Pia, where we go to the House of Commons tomorrow and we see one mood. And then by Tuesday morning, the mood has completely shifted depending on the results of these by-elections. So it will absolutely have a lot of significance and a lot of symbolic significance. It's not going to change the course of this government right now. And Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says it absolutely, determinatively will not change the course of his leadership. But there's no way of saying that this will not be a very symbolic moment for both the Conservatives, the NDP, the Bloc, and the Liberals. For the Liberals, the Montreal by-election is essentially hallowed ground for them. It's a riding that was held by Paul Martin, who was the Prime Minister. He was the Finance Minister through the 90s and is a, you know, very well-regarded sort of statesman of the Liberal Party. And if they're not able to hold on to the riding in this critical moment, it just will be painted as another nail in the coffin of the Liberal Party right now. On the flip side, there's also a lot riding on the NDP. The NDP have set their hopes very high to be the ones to win the Montreal by-election, which the Bloc also believes they might be in contention for. And so the NDP have divided their resources between holding on to this Winnipeg seat and winning the Montreal seat. And it's very possible we could see a situation where they don't win either one. Mm. That will put immense pressure on Jagmeet Singh and raise more questions about his leadership. And then, of course, for the Conservatives, if they are able to scrape back that seat in Winnipeg, it will be another good sign for them because they won that in 2011 when they won their majority government. And so you can just sort of see the picture they would paint then.
Let's say the Conservatives don't win either of the two seats tomorrow. We have Pierre Poilievre pushing hard to get a non-confidence vote passed in the House to bring down the government and trigger a federal election. Would that, do you think, change the Conservatives' calculation of pushing so hard?
No, I don't think it would, because even they're not in contention in Montreal, first of all. It's not a seat they're trying for, and they're not expected to be a major player there. So that one sort of doesn't factor in. And what I was told by one Conservative is they will see a win if they're even just able to narrow the margin of victory for the NDP to 5 points. Remember, the NDP won with about 20-point margin in the last election in 2021. So if they are able to eat in so decisively into NDP support, they will take that as a win. It's also important to note for your listeners, you know, we're journalists, we like drama. Change is what's interesting to cover. It's possible it's a total status quo by-election result and the Liberals hold Montreal, the NDP hold Winnipeg. And then it doesn't dramatically change the course of history, but either way, we are heading into a fall sitting that will be more challenging for the Liberals, even if they hold on to this.
Yeah, let's talk about the Liberals and their caucus retreat, which they held, just shy of a week ago out in BC. Coming out of that, how united are there? I know a lot of things happen in caucus retreats that we don't hear about, but there was a little bit of disgruntlement by at least one MP about Justin Trudeau's leadership. But coming out of that, how are the Liberals going to enter into the House tomorrow?
I would say that they are describing it as united. My sense is that it's more a resignation. The MPs and caucus members that I speak to and ministers that I speak to are all very clear in the expectation that Justin Trudeau will remain as leader and believe that he will lead them into the next election. And so given that context, there is no sort of plan for this civil war that we saw between Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin to push Jean Chrétien out. There is no internal revolt expected to change that course. And so for the MPs who have decided to seek re-election, it's a resignation and a unity in a sense to buckle down and try and do the work and make the best of the situation they're in, rather than one necessarily where they think they're going to sweep the table in the next election. And it speaks in large part, Pia, to the power that Justin Trudeau has over this party. Many of the MPs know that they are elected because of his role in 2015. And so they are giving him the space to make his own choices about his leadership. And that's in part because of that, but also because they say that they don't see anybody waiting in the wings, that would make it much better for them.
Okay. And the NDP also had its retreat. How's that caucus feeling after, Jagmeet Singh ripped up the NDP Liberal deal? That's his words, by the way. He said ripped up. How are they feeling about all of this?
I think there is likely relief among the caucus that they no longer have this automatic support deal with the Liberals. It was something that was hanging over their heads. It's something that the Conservatives have made a lot of hay on, put a lot of political pressure on them, to the point, Pia, where the Conservative Party has rolled out campaign lawn signs in the Winnipeg by-election that don't show a Conservative face. It shows Jagmeet Singh and Justin Trudeau shaking hands, and the sign says, "Sell out Singh, vote against the carbon tax." So it has hit a nerve, that deal. And so I think they will be happy to be out from under it. They will, though, face tough questions if on that first confidence vote that they face in the House of Commons, they still end up supporting the government. It's possible they won't, because the Bloc have also said they will happily negotiate with the Liberals. But if the NDP are not able to successfully distance themselves from the Liberals, they might not get the political wins they were hoping for.
Oh, there's so much maneuvering to come, isn't there? And, you know, the MPs are heading back to the House tomorrow. How would you describe the political scene, and what should Canadians be preparing for?
I think it has become more unpredictable. One senior staffer sort of described to me that, you know, the parliamentary side of the Prime Minister's office is in a bit more disarray than it was 2 weeks ago. But moreover, everybody in the Prime Minister's office or around his entourage, ministers, MPs, and staff, are quite convinced that they will be able to find negotiating partners in the Bloc Québécois and the NDP at different times. And because it's not just the NDP they're relying on, because the Bloc can also give them the support they need to stay in government, they're still quite confident that they will be able to bring this government at least into the spring, if not still to the end of the term at the beginning of next fall. So there's clearly lots that could still go wrong for them, but they believe they still have many options to negotiate, to stay in power. And time is what the Liberals say they need. Time is what they believe will turn around their fortunes, ease economic anxieties that Canadians are facing, and then allow voters to look at the Prime Minister in a different light than they do right now.
Lots to come. Marika, thanks as always for your analysis. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Pia.
Marika Walsh is the Globe and Mail's senior political reporter in its Ottawa bureau. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. This is the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio and on your mobile phone, wherever you are, via the CBC News app. You can download the app for free and use the local tab to stream us live. You can also get in touch with us by sending an email to sunday@cbc.ca. Let's now rewind to 1939.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Well, it's been 85 years since Dorothy and her little dog Toto got swept up by a tornado and set upon their journey to meet the Wizard of Oz. The movie is still a classic, and it spawned a song that is still finding new life today. So we are taking a trip down the yellow brick road to pay homage to Over the Rainbow, a song I used to sing as a kid back in music competitions, and many years later, a certain ukulele version, we'll get to that soon, was one of our wedding songs. And I'm sure many of you have your own stories and relationship to Over the Rainbow. Columbia University musicologist Walter Frisch says there's a good reason why the song is still ubiquitous and so emblematic. Here's Walter with the story of how two songwriters tapped into sentiment that has spanned generations.
So Harold Arlen and E.Y. or Yip Harburg were two first-generation Jewish composers in New York, and they grew up in an era when popular music and jazz was really blossoming. And Harburg loved wordplay, poetry. He loved the operettas of Gilbert and Sullivan. And Arlen, for his part, loved jazz. He actually was an arranger and a performer in a number of jazz bands. And so they were both fairly well established when they were brought together. I mean, Harburg had worked already on some other shows. He was actually quite well known for a song he wrote during the Depression, maybe the most iconic song of the Depression, Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime?
And Harold Arlen had already been working on, well, starting at the Cotton Club in Harlem, where he wrote Stormy Weather.
Everything I had is gone, stormy weather. Since
and then when MGM wanted to make a film, The Wizard of Oz, a live-action film, and this was 1937, 38, they saw themselves, MGM, in competition, if you will, or they wanted to sort of surpass Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which Disney had produced the year before.
I hope, I hope, I hope, I hope, I hope, it's home from which we go.
And they thought, well, maybe we can do a film with song and fantasy that would not be a cartoon. Arthur Freed, who was the associate producer at MGM, who would go on to do many of these great Hollywood film musicals, was looking for a composer and lyricist pair who he thought could capture the sort of both childlike and sophisticated spirit that he wanted in this story. And he had heard a musical that Arlen had written called Hooray for What, a Broadway show in New York. Not super successful, but it had a number in it. I think it was called In the Shade of the New Apple Tree.
In the shade of the new apple tree.
Freed felt had a kind of folksy, gentle, but kind of appealing style. He thought, that's the style I want for the music of The Wizard of Oz. There is some ambiguity, let's say, of how this image of Over the Rainbow or the rainbow came. As Harburg himself pointed out, there is no rainbow in the original Wizard of Oz story. In fact, Kansas is very gray and this and that, and Dorothy gets to Oz, but there is no rainbow in that first story. At a certain point, Harburg, you know, sort of claimed credit for coming up with the rainbow idea. He said that he gave him that idea of a rainbow before Arlen started to compose, and Arlen usually tended to compose the music before the lyrics were written. So Arlen went away and, you know, he worked on the song, and he was having trouble because this was going to be the only ballad in the score. There was always a slot for a Kansas song. It was going to be the only number in Kansas before she got to Oz. There was some question about what it would be. Would it be a song that celebrated the loveliness of Kansas? And Arlen and Harburg come on and they say, well, this is really more about, sure, she loves Kansas, but Kansas is not being very good to her. She has a aunt and uncle that kind of criticize her, and there's some, this Miss Gulch is, you know, I mean, she wants to get away.
Ann, just listen to what Miss Gulch did to Toto.
Dorothy, please, we're trying to count.
Oh, but Ann, she hit him.
Don't bother us now, honey. You see, this old incubator's gone bad, and we're like to lose a lot of our chicks.
She wants to get away somewhere she can be happy and fulfilled and stuff, longing for someplace else. And so that's where this sort of image of Over the Rainbow, wherever it originally came from, gets developed. There's a wonderful book about the film Wizard of Oz by Salman Rushdie, And his interpretation of Over the Rainbow, he calls it a hymn to elsewhere, and he sees it or has interpreted it, or growing up, he interpreted it as a sort of yearning to get elsewhere. I'll just quote briefly from it. Over the Rainbow is or ought to be the anthem of all the world's migrants, all those who go in search of the place where the dreams you dare to dream really do come true. It is a celebration of escape, a grand paean to the uprooted self, a hymn to elsewhere. So that idea now, of course, Salman Rushdie is writing that in 1992, but I think that that could well be part of the original spirit of the song. And it's been interpreted in that way, you know, I think not just by Rushdie, but by many generations since then. So the sense of not belonging, feeling you don't belong and want it to be someplace where you do belong.
Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me.
I mean, it was a popular song from the moment that it appeared in the film, and particularly as sung by Judy Garland.
That's where you
You just can't separate the song from Judy Garland, although other people have sung it and played it since. The sense of longing in her voice, this special pathos and catch in her throat that communicates it, I think helped cement that impression. I mean, she did sing the song throughout her career, and her interpretation changed, you know, from this more hopeful thing. And as her voice deepened a bit and as her life became more complicated with all the troubles that many of them visited upon her, marriages, the substance dependence and various things that she went through, it followed her throughout her life. And she was okay with that. You know, she knew it became her kind of theme song in a way. But it's also true that it became a kind of anthem for the LGBTQ movement before it was called that. Certainly in the times around the late 60s, Judy Garland became a kind of gay icon. And when she died in 1969, it was just before Stonewall. Some people say that, you know, that was one of the reasons that it happened. Her Carnegie Hall concert in 1961, this iconic concert, was attended by many people, including gay men.
The next one is sort of a strip tease temper. We don't do it, we just talk about it. Heck.
And this film scholar Richard Dyer actually documented the impressions and feelings of many gay men who attended her concerts. And many of them felt that Garland had a resonance with them because this idea of getting over the rainbow and overcoming a struggle. She, in one concert in 1968, she said, "I finally made it over the rainbow. Thanks to you all," she said to her audience, largely gay men, and they saw her as a kind of somebody who was, you know, helping them. The friends of Dorothy, her three male companions, are kind of, you know, gentle and loving. And the Cowardly Lion, I mean, this has been written about. He's, you know, he wears bows in his hair and he confesses to having been a sissy. He says, "I'm afraid there's no denying I've been a dandelion.
I'm afraid there's no denying I'm just a dandelion, a fate I don't deserve."
So there is this connection. And actually, the rainbow flag, which was designed by Gilbert Baker, I interviewed him and I said, because, you know, was the rainbow flag inspired by that? He said, well, not actually. He said it was more, I think the song "It's a Rainbow" by the Rolling Stones and a few other uses of the word rainbow.
She comes in color.
But he admitted and, you know, celebrated the fact that the association of the song and Judy Garland and that, you know, kind of spirit with the flag since that time is part of its history. When I've talked about the song in public, so many people have come up to me and said, "Oh, you know, that song, my mother sang it to me when I was a baby," or "that song was sung at my parents' wedding," or associations with specific moments and events. It's also true that it has become often a song of solace. I mean, some of the examples I found is that shortly after Sandy Hook, the massacre of the school children, one of the school teachers in a nearby town in Newton, Connecticut, actually had all the students get together, and it's up on YouTube, a recorded Over the Rainbow, or, you know, as a source of hope and comfort. this Hawaiian singer, very famous Hawaiian singer, Israel Kamakawiwa Ole, who recorded it. And that became one of the biggest selling records of all time. And a lot of people actually thought he wrote the song. And there, it was immensely popular, and it was connected with sort of desire for Hawaiian independence and self-determination, because the rainbow is a symbol in Hawaii.
Someday you wish upon a star, wake up where the clouds are far behind. Be well
traveled. He picked that up as to celebrate Hawaii, but also to celebrate the idea that there was a better future he was hoping for Hawaii. Yeah, so many different meanings put onto the song. Some vocalists have actually steered clear of it. I mean, Barbara Streisand recorded it maybe just once, and she said, "I've always loved this song. I wanted to sing it, but it was so associated with Judy Garland that I hesitated."
But the lyrics felt so right, so relevant tonight that, what the hell, I decided to sing it. Why? Oh, why?
I never cease to be amazed at the craftsmanship of it and its ability to communicate. I mean, that's one of the things about these songwriters. The level of craft, the detail that Arlen puts into the song and that Harbour puts into his lyrics, and yet it never obscures the beauty of the melody or the flow of the harmony or the perfection of the lyrics. I think, you know, in its own way, it's as great a work as, well, you know, I don't want to say it's as great as Beethoven's Eroica. It's different. But the level of craftsmanship and expertise that goes into a song like this. And so that comes back to me each time.
You heard from Walter Frisch, a musicologist and the author of Arlen and Harburg's Over the Rainbow. Thank you to our producer, Levi Garber, for putting that piece together. Canada's immigration system has long been seen as the envy of the world. But here at home, new data shows that the issue has become a source of worry. Polling from the Angus Reid Institute shows concern over immigration has nearly quadrupled in the past 2 years, with one in five Canadians calling it the top issue for the country. Next week, the Liberal government's changes to the Temporary Foreign Workers Program come into effect. The new rules crack down on the number of low-wage temporary foreign worker employers can hire and in what jurisdictions. Meantime, there continues to be drastic changes in international study permits. They are projected to drop by almost half due to a federal cap on foreign students. So what does this all mean for the changing face and economic picture of Canada? We're going to talk about that in a bit. But first, what's it like to navigate Canada's oftentimes confusing web of immigration policy? Mahekdeep Singh came to Canada as an international student in 2018. He is now struggling to navigate his next steps. Mahekdeep, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You came to Canada from Punjab, India in 2018, and you came here as a student. You took a HVAC course at a college in Peterborough, Ontario. Why did you choose Canada as the country that you wanted to come to?
Canada was the best option to build a future, to build a career, to build a family. It was not like totally my decision. It was a bit my parents' decision to come here in Canada.
I know the sacrifices it takes to leave a country and come here. I'm the kid of Indian immigrants who came to Canada in 1968. So many years later, the sacrifices are similar in many ways. Tell me about the sacrifices you and your family made so that you had the ability to come here.
The biggest sacrifice is I have to leave my family, right? So where I was born, I grew up, I left my my city, my place, my home. Then for that, actually, it took too much money to come here because, international students have to pay three times than the domestic students. So, and then GIC and then expenses and all that. So some of my parents' savings and we have to sell our land. And also, we have to borrow some money from our relatives. Then, yeah, everything this made me to come to Canada.
Mm. Your parents, you know, helped you with all this money, but what was your hopes and goals?
So it was totally to build my career here in Canada. So very first thing was to complete the studies. So after that, as we know, it was promoted as a PR pathway in India. Then it was totally to focus on permanent residency, whatever pathways they provide. Just follow those pathways. In India, there isn't that much safety, security, and the unemployment rate is too much high. At the very first year of my postgraduate work permit, I was independent. I was doing everything by my own. I was having a car. I was having a rental house, and I was living a good life here. So that influenced me to stay here in Canada. It is too good to be here. Yeah.
It's too good to be here. That's nice to hear. After you graduated, you were hoping to get PR, permanent residency, through the provincial nominee program. And then you tried a pathway called the Canadian Experience Class. Tell me what it's been like dealing with that.
So when I just completed my graduation, I started looking into the streams. I got to know there are these streams and I can be the best fit in this one. I started working on it. Now they have changed their priorities. They want healthcare workers and construction workers and transportation workers over us. But they never told us these things in the previous years, that the country needs these people in 2024 or 2025. If they had done so, then we have focused on those things that country needs. But again, in 2022, 2023, whatever they told us, we were doing that according to the books, by the books. But here we are still suffering with these policy changes.
What's the emotional impact of all of that?
Whenever I think of to leave the country, I got goosebumps. I got tears in my eyes. Because, you know, like spending 6 years of my life, 6 crucial years of my life in this country, habitual to this life is a dream, I can say. And I was totally dreaming to build my career, my family here in Canada. Even my fiance is right now living with me. Don't know what's going to happen in the future if I have to leave the country.
You've worked in security. You went to North Bay, Ontario to work as a baker. You had a post-grad work permit. It expired in July. And so now you're here in our country on a visitor's visa, hoping to re-enter through the TFW program, the Temporary Foreign Worker Program. You just kind of alluded there to the anxieties and the stress of all of this. How are you thinking about things now?
I haven't got decision on my visitor record file yet. So maybe they're going to refuse it. Maybe they're going to give me for 6 months or a year. I will stay here for that much time. I will go for the option, whatever option I will have. Even it is a temporary foreign worker program, or if I picked my file in CEC because I have a good score in Canadian Experience Class 2. But as they pause the files and the score is too high nowadays. So, yeah. I think the options will change in the coming time because they're still changing the policies. They are still changing the programs. So it is different. Every morning is different. And I have to take the decision every morning, every night, so that I can do something to stay here in Canada. I don't want to do anything illegal. I don't want to do anything wrong. I'm doing everything by the books. But if my status got expired, if they refuse, or if my visitor record got expired, I will leave the country. I will try from my back home India, if I can come back in Canada. But let's see how it works in future. I can't say anything right now.
You're part of an advocacy group that's been holding regular protests in Brampton, Ontario. There are other similar rallies that have been happening and continue to happen across Canada. What do you want people in our country to know about what you and others in this group are facing?
The very first thing I want to know them is, we have done everything that Canada government, their immigration, told us. whatever they told, whatever the pathways they given to us, we followed all those things. Now we are eligible, we are qualified, we are experienced in every single thing, but now due to elections, they are just putting everything on international students and immigrants. There is an anti-immigrant propaganda going on, housing crisis, job crisis, but we are not the reason of that. They are the policies, they are the things, the decisions that government made in the previous years put us, even the Canadians and us immigrants, in this situation now. So I just want them to come at our protest location, ask us just what is the exact thing. But again, I will say we have done every single thing we can do. Now the government has changed the rules in the mid of the game. That's why we are suffering.
Mehakdeep, thank you for sharing your story with us. That was Mehakdeep Singh. Armin Yelnisian is an economist and the Atkinson Fellow on the Future of Workers. Mikhail Scudarud is a professor of economics at the University of Waterloo in Waterloo, Ontario, the director of the Canadian Labour Economics Forum, and the Roger Phillips Scholar of Social Policy at the C.D. Howe Institute. Both Armin and Mikhail have been studying and writing about immigration for decades. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Pia.
Mikhail, let me begin with you. We'll dig in sort of to the bigger issues in just a bit. But when you hear Mehakdeep's story, what is going through your mind?
Well, it's heartbreaking, Pia. I talk to students, international students, every day. I teach in the fall term over 600 first-year students. I hear the stories, and Mehakdeep's story is not unique. The system has changed. It's the goalposts are constantly moving. And the one thing you expect from a government is when people uproot their lives and migrate to Canada, that they know what the rules of the game are. And those have been constantly changing. And it's heartbreaking to listen to.
Armin, how about you?
Oh, what he said. I mean, this is like people are entering the country on a lottery, on the hopes that they are going to be able to gamble. I'm listening to Mehakdeep's story and thinking he's been doing this for 6 years. He'll do anything to do it. Everything he's done has been legal, and he is being branded as somebody that we shouldn't have. He's exactly the type of person we should be building our future on. And it just is bewildering that we are not doing more to keep these people that come here, give up so much and want so much to build a life here, as my parents did, as probably everybody on this call just did.
Yeah, my parents, Mikhail. How'd
yep,
your family?
Mine yep, too. Yep, I there came you go. Here as an immigrant, as a child. Yep, exactly the same.
Okay, so Armin, this individual story that we just heard of Mehakdeep, and like you just said, like we all have our stories, right, is connected to this much bigger story of our Canada and also the enormous population boom we have seen in recent years. So just to put some context around how much it's grown, Canada's population grew by 3.2% last year. That amounts to 1.3 million people. It is the fastest rate since the late 50s, and the increase is largely through immigration. So if we can just back up for a moment, Armin, why have we seen this kind of growth?
Largely because of what is happening everywhere in the global north, which is a demographic transition from the baby boomer era to the baby boomers no longer can work era. And in the intervening four decades, we have seen falling fertility rates. So the solution to tightening labor markets has been to bring more people in, except the pandemic poured fuel on that fire. And so there was a great deal of oversteering to meet legitimate and illegitimate claims of labor shortages. Legitimate if you say that, especially in areas that were already depopulating or aging, like small towns in eastern Canada, Quebec and East have been really having a terrible time trying to find people to provide the services for the people that are remaining in these smaller towns. And that's true across the country, but on stilts in eastern Canada. But there's also large employers that are using this moment to say, we can't find a Canadian to do this job, put in parentheses, at the wages that we are offering or under the working conditions we are offering. And they are getting a good hearing from a federal government that is very nervous about seeing the number of small businesses decline, the ones that hung on by their fingernails throughout the pandemic, hung on by their fingernails as interest rates rose. And so they're getting a very good hearing. They're a very effective lobby. And we definitely oversteered in the direction of making life easier for them for reasons that maybe Mikhail and I would also be persuaded by if we were in the driver's seat. We are not. And that distance from having to make these very, very difficult decisions, make it very easy to complain about how things were done. But we already have a sense that they're walking this stuff back, that they themselves acknowledge they oversteered.
Okay, we'll talk more about the temporary foreign workers aspect of this in a bit, but I want to stick with the international students because I'm kind of breaking our conversation down in these two different groups. I know many, many people fit under them and in many ways. But Mikhail, you know, Mehekti said, like, his work permit expired in July. And I think you estimated that approximately 130,000 permits could, those kinds of permits could expire this year, though the specific data is hard to come by. What are the consequences of that number of permits expiring, or what do you think might happen?
It's hard to put a number on it, Pia. So that is very much a very rough estimate. I mean, you know, historically we had many international students coming to Canada who came because the value of the education they were getting was high and it was valued by employers in their home country. So they would come here and study and then return home. What has happened over time, and I would actually characterize what's happened over time as a bit differently than Armin. This was very much a part of the Liberal government's agenda. This was, if you look at Bill Morneau's Economic Growth Council, that was led by the two founders of what's called the Century Initiative, who had very ambitious population growth objectives for Canada. They said we needed a population of 100 million people by 2100. That's been a very key part of the Liberal government's agenda. And the population growth started to take off in 2016. When you look at the numbers, this isn't a post-pandemic thing. That's when it started to take off. So what's happened is migrants are increasingly coming here believing that the way to PR status is through these education programs. So they're not coming here for the education anymore. They're coming here, they're enrolling in those programs simply because that's the ticket to PR status, and they'll pay anything and do anything they need to do. And so the government now has just completely changed the goalposts. And I think that's the fundamental part of the problem here.
Armin, you mentioned there are so many pathways, and we heard that from Mehekti too. He's just trying to navigate the system. I think when almost any Canadian travels abroad, oftentimes someone comes up and say, how do I come to Canada? And I would say, I don't know. I was born here. I don't know. But even if I did know, I think I'd have a hard time explaining it to them. Why are there so many streams?
I don't know. I don't know how policy gets made in that respect, but I think there's constantly people negotiating for a change to the rules, and these rules get changed quickly. To McCall's point, absolutely he is right that the Century Initiative was a overriding issue that we, the so-called country of immigrants, decided we needed more people. They just never clarified that they don't care whether it's permanently temporary people or permanent people. I mean, the story about I want to come here, I wanted to create a life for myself, I wanted to have children here, that is the Canadian story. Our story was not one of, you know, come here and take your chances. We have a whole industry that has blown up around the world to recruit these people on a false promise. They cannot promise that they will make that two-step transition, come here as an international student, and you're on a track to getting a job here, and then you're on a track to becoming a citizen. They can't make that promise. But what we have seen is, because there's been so much pressure because of news like this and because of this absolutely appalling story that was covered in the newspaper, that, you know, I think it was Rupa Banerjee, who is an immigration specialist at Toronto Metropolitan University, told me that when we were looking through how many different pathways are there, she said that there are 2,000 distinct pathways, or ish, 2,000-ish distinct pathways, because you can do exactly what this student did, which is, let me try this, let me try that, let me try the other thing. And then for a period of time, you might be undocumented. And then there's all these little mini kind of boutique niche regularization programs where, yeah, you might have run out of time, let me give you a little bit more time, but no promise that you'll become a citizen. All that said, we know that these are like the grade A selection for becoming future citizens. And we're seeing, based on StatCan reports, we're seeing a rising share of these students actually making the transition ultimately after 5 years, after 10 years, into permanent residency status. But that's 5 or 10 years of not knowing which way you're going. And basically, it's a crapshoot, 50-50 chance that you'll make it. It's terrible.
I was looking at an Abacus polling data from this morning. The top issues for Canadians, one of them is immigration. So it's about 27%. So 27% of the people polled said immigration is my top issue. It's broken down by what party you said you supported. So 54% were Conservatives, 9% Liberals, 6% NDPs. I put that out there in a backdrop kind of way to the backlash that we have seen or the changing support for immigrants in many Western countries. Mikhail, because I think it's important to understand that context, has there been a shift in empathy by Canadians towards people coming to our country and wanting to stay and letting them stay?
I'm an economist. I deal with economic data, not with opinion polls. I mean, certainly I've seen some of those opinion polls, and just my own experience from, you know, I talk to people in my own world there, and sure, I see that there has been a change in sentiment. It was entirely predictable. You know, as I said earlier, I'm an immigrant myself to this country. I was embraced by my family. We came here with no other family in Canada. We were embraced by this country. If there's anything that's motivated my research over the past 20 years and motivated me to step into the public sphere, which I didn't do for many years, you know, you didn't see hear me on shows like this for many, many years, is I'm really worried that the direction this government has taken immigration in is ultimately undermining public support for immigration. That really, really worries me. You know, I have no public, I have no private interest in any of this. But I really get quite impassioned by it because I think there's a real risk in the way that they've taken immigration policy. There's been a lot of bad policy decisions made over the past few years.
I mean, I just want you to weigh in sort of the context we're having this discussion.
I agree that we have done a lot of bad oversteering on policy, but also the sea we swim in politically has changed. And that is happening all around the world. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in the United States. We are not immune from this. The people that are out there that would like to whip up a divide and conquer sentiment, and often it's people that can no longer work, like they're retired, that are saying, you know, they're taking our jobs from us. It's like, dudes, you do not want to do these jobs. You don't want your children to do these jobs. We want people to do these jobs or else our communities are going to be in decline. And it's just low-hanging fruit for the disruptors out there, the political disruptors. And we are seeing exactly the same pattern everywhere. And no, we don't eat pets in Canada, but you know that dialogue is coming here.
Hmm. You know, one of the other kind of arguments that's out there is that there is no one gets a guarantee to stay in this country. And so there are some people who suggest, look, if you're coming to our country, it's up to you to understand what the possibilities are and understand that you might just come here and have to go home. At the same time, if we look at the international students issue, there have been government sites and promotional videos literally that have the slogan, study, explore, work, stay. Mikhail, how confusing is the message for people who want to come to Canada and whose responsibility is sort of to clarify, like, hey, you might be able to come for a while, but not forever?
I mean, it's clearly it's ultimately the federal government that sets the rules. And so when people come here, of course, you know, even Mahakti, I'm sure he knew there was some chance that he wasn't going to be, there was a risk, let's put it that way. I'm sure he recognized that. But these are expectations. People have probabilities in their mind. And that they, what was shown to the world, to migrants around the world, is Canada is opening up to the world. And we have a new system in place called the International Education Strategy that is going to prioritize international students for permanent residency. And the way you obtain permanent residency is by coming here as a student at any level. All the growth happened pretty much, like overwhelmingly, the growth happened at the college level. So these were two-year diplomas. The government changed the rules so that you don't actually, we kind of changed the signal by changing the rules around how many hours you can work off campus during your studies. You know, they removed all those rules. So they said, we don't actually want you here as students. Like, we know you're on a study permit, but that study permit is actually a de facto work permit. So you can work as many hours as you want off campus. So for sure, we see that in the data. I've got a student working on a project now. We see a huge increase in the number of off-campus hours students are working. So they're not clearly not here for education. They're here to work and get permanent residency status. And so this has become the biggest part of our temporary foreign worker program are, you know, people on study permits working at Tim Hortons to make ends meet and hoping to get this credential at, you know, from a college that's going to provide them with a pathway to PR status.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Pia Chattopadha, and I'm speaking with economists Armin Yalnizian and Mikhail Scudarud about changes to our immigration programs that are coming into effect. Armin, one of the changes happens next week. These are recently announced changes to the temporary foreign worker program. They come into effect September 26. So again, just to sort of set the table here, these measures are not going to apply to certain sectors. Those sectors include healthcare, agriculture, food and fish processing, and construction. They also do not apply to rural areas or any metropolitan areas with less than 6% unemployment rate. Nonetheless, the TFW program was recently condemned by the UN Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Slavery because it was, quote, a breeding ground for contemporary forms of slavery. I want to play a bit of tape just before we get to the meat of this conversation. Some business organizations, including the industry group Restaurants Canada, say small businesses and communities, especially those smaller ones, will suffer. Listen to this perspective.
We've always faced a shortage of cooks in Canada. It's gone on for decades now, and operators have tried many, many different things to find cooks. It's just one of those in-demand professions within our industry. It is an avenue of last resort for a restaurateur. It's not something they want to do, but when there's very little labor market for them to draw upon, they have no choice but to use temporary foreign workers. Yeah, so I was speaking with one operator who owns several restaurants in Southern Ontario, and he said he doesn't even take down job advertisements for cooks. He just leaves it up, hoping to get somebody to come in through the door. One of our big concerns with the changes to the program the government has made is rural and remote areas of Canada. So I think about Labrador City or Goose Bay. They have been using temporary foreign workers to fill these positions for many, many years. It's well accepted by the community. The community understands that without these workers, you're not going to have your coffee shops. You're not going to have your fast food restaurant. There's no labor market. It's an aging population. It's very rural. It's isolated. And as a result, the temporary foreign worker program allows citizens in those communities to actually have those services, things that people want, gathering places for communities, right? And because it costs so much to bring in a temporary foreign worker, you know, anywhere from $12,000 to $14,000 at the high end, it could lead to restaurants that will cut back on hours or even shut down because it's just too hard to find these positions locally.
That was Richard Alexander from Restaurants Canada. Armin Yalnizian, how are you assessing the changes to temporary foreign workers that are coming into effect next week?
We're talking a lot about rolling back the number of people, putting a hard cap on November the 1st. We'll have our first hard cap on temporary residents permitted into the country to go along with the permanent residence cap that we have had forever. Long overdue. It's hard to do, hard to get the right number, but at least it's a signal to your point earlier, Pia. It's a signal that you are taking a risk coming here as a temporary person on a temporary permit. But I just want to make the point that intake is one thing and the people who are already here is another. And we've got hundreds of thousands of people in that category, in this permanently temporary category, where people like Richard Alexander would, I think, also argue if they're good enough to work here, they're good enough to stay here. So we need actually policies, not just to control the taps, how many people are coming in, but also what do you do with these people when you come in to get to that point that the UN Rapporteur Tomoyo Obukata said that, you know, these create the conditions for exploitation, not just in agriculture, but in any area where somebody will not say a peep because they don't want to be deported before they have that chance at the lottery of staying. And the last point I will make is go ahead and shut down the taps, and you will see more businesses like the one that Richard is talking about fold. And that means that either we will have not a short-term recession, which is two or three quarters of GDP shrinkage, but a longer phase of contraction because smaller businesses can't make it. And that doesn't mean that they should have temporary workers, but we will need more people coming into the country. So let's change the rules so that when people do come into the country for the needs that businesses say they have, they can stay because those needs are not temporary. They are permanent, as Richard said.
Mikhail, how are you assessing the changes to the temporary foreign workers program? Many of the people who come in through this are low-wage workers, I should add to this conversation.
You know, I have a very different perspective than my co-panelist Armin does on this issue. We could have a much longer panel just on this issue. I think it's a big problem. I think the way we talk about labor shortages in this problem in this country is a big problem. In the summer of 2022, we know that job vacancies were hitting an all-time high. There was a lot of discussion about whether this was a problem, and overwhelmingly, the view and the talk from many people, including my co-panelists, was that it was a problem, that it was a consequence of the aging population, that people were just leaving the labor force, and there was nobody fill the vacancies anymore. I wrote an op-ed in the Globe and Mail at that time. You can go back and read it. And the headline was, "The Labor Shortage is an Illusion." And indeed, you know, as it was quite simply a consequence of the inflation, that the fact that the prices of goods were increasing faster than what business had to pay their workers. When that happens, there's profit margins are going up and labor demand goes up. This is basic, you know, econ 101. And so as prices went down, so did labor shortages. And now, you know, labor markets are more slack in Canada today than they were then in 2022. There is this idea that labor shortage is a problem is crazy talk. It's nonsense. It really is. I mean, when I ask my students, would you rather graduate in an economy where jobs are scarce or where workers are scarce? I mean, they don't think labor shortage. They love it. When workers are scarce, you know, they don't have to queue up for jobs. The companies are looking for them. That's not a problem. That's really good for productivity, in fact. If we believe in capitalism, we want businesses to compete. Business failures are actually a very healthy part of a good productive economy, because it's, you know, survival of the fittest. If you can't use your workers productively, if your only margin of making profit is to keep your labor costs low, you have no God-given right to exist. You have to compete, and we have a labor productivity problem in this country. Why not embrace those labor shortages and celebrate them?
I know you just said that you and Armin probably disagree on this issue, so Armin, I want to get your perspective on what Mikhail just said there.
I think you need another show. I mean, I have not been arguing for cheap temporary labor at any point in my life. And prior to the pandemic, we had the lowest unemployment rates we had seen since the 1970s, and that will continue. We saw 1 million people added to our economy. A third of the labor market exited since 2019. We had fewer people, about 270,000 people come into the labor market. That includes the newcomers. So we do have a hydraulic effect that is happening from a historically high baby boomer. We've had 40 years of labor surplus from the 1980s to the 2020s. And it is very difficult for people to wrap their heads around the fact that, yes, the economy is growing, and that's why we need immigration. But without immigration, we would see a net contraction. So for those people that say, just shut the doors, keep the jobs for the Canadians, you will see a contracting economy. And that is exactly what is happening in other jurisdictions that have made this same gambit politically. And it is a political gambit. It's got nothing to do with the economics of the moment. As for wanting businesses to survive and be productive, 100% I'm on that team. I would just caution people that many small businesses will fail, and that's fine. But we will not have seen that kind of failure rate, and what will be left is the big cheeses standing. So there is an issue about the business ecosystem not to be subsidized by cheap labor, but just to be aware that when you just say let them fail, something big will happen in its wake.
Okay, I can't promise either of you another show on this, but I'm sure we'll have more conversations about it. And I appreciate both your perspectives this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pia.
Armin Yalnizian is an economist and is the Atkinson Fellow on the Future of Workers. Mikhail Skudarud is a professor of economics at the University of Waterloo, director of the Canadian Labour Economics Forum, and the Roger Phillips Scholar of Social Policy at the C.D. Howe Institute. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. You're listening to the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio and streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the local tab and press play. Well, it is time for another installment of Word Processing, or is it Processing, our ongoing look at language, and I do believe this one will be particularly brilliant. So, curl up with a cuppa or even a cheeky boozy brunch. Yep, today we're looking at the way English speakers on this side of the pond have been increasingly keen on Britishisms, words, phrases, even pronunciations transplanted from Britain to these shores. From posh to kerfuffle, writer Ben Yagoda has had a go with the topic for his spot-on new book. It is called Gobsmacked. Listen, I tried to get as many of them as I could in there. Ben, good morning to you.
Good morning. I lost count. I think well over 20. Well done. Well done, you.
I'll add another one. Awfully nice to meet you here on our program.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, Ben, I was surprised awfully the way I just used it. I guess I've just never really thought about it deeply. I didn't realize it was a Britishism. You say it's one of the original British invasion words.
I tracked down the first person to complain about Britishism is a man named Richard White in the late 1800s. And one of the ones that he noted was that word awfully, meaning very. Mm. And he didn't like that. He said that that was an import from Britain and had come to the U.S. and presumably Canada. And he didn't approve.
So you've been blogging about these kinds of words. You call them noobs, N-O-O-B-S, or not one-off Britishisms, meaning they're quite present. And one of the first ones you observed, I thought that was so cool, is gone missing. Now, Ben, I went to journalism school like almost 30 years ago. And at the time, I was told never write in a story someone has gone missing, say disappeared. And that's always stuck with me.
Where was your journalism school?
Here in Toronto.
In Toronto. So interesting. So I started reading that in the British press in the 90s, maybe when you were in journalism school. It was totally new thing to me. I was used to disappeared, vanished, and so forth. But then it got picked up in the U.S., and I kind of dated that to a particular news story, the disappearance of a congressional intern named Chandra Levy in 2001. And using these databases and various resources, that was when it started to be used frequently in the U.S. Mm. And it's interesting that you were taught not to use it, because I ran into some internal memos from the BBC where they sniffed at it too. And it was a relatively new term in Britain. I mean, it didn't exist before the 20th century. But got picked up in the U.S., so popular here now that when people ask me about the book or the blog and I say, well, it's like terms like go missing, and they don't believe me that it was not always a U.S. term. It's become so common and so ubiquitous now.
We're told not to use it because people don't actively go missing. It's not like you go to the store. That's why I was told.
Except disappeared, that sounds like a magician's act. You know, now you will disappear. I understand.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. You mentioned a database, and it's important here. This isn't just you going to the UK and like anecdotally noticing, hey, they use different terms. You actually, and then they import them to the US. You actually have proof, so to speak, to back this up.
I do. I have the receipts, as they say. yeah, I mean, I would not have probably been able to do the blog or the book without something called Google Books Ngram Viewer. Google Books has essentially digitized virtually every book ever published. And you can't read them all because some are under copyright, but the Ngram Viewer allows you to search over time for the use of any word or phrase and show in a x-axis, y-axis graph how popular it's been from year to year, decade to decade, century to century. And wait, there's more. It allows you to look at books in Britain and the United States. You can compare the two. And yeah, so you can see exactly when a phrase started being used, when it got picked up in the other country, and it's an amazing resource. Now, one thing it doesn't do is separate out Canada versus the United States. So there's a gap there.
We'll talk more about Canada in a bit. We are a mixture of both British and American English, and we often argue over such words like, I don't know, I'm trying to think, like process, those kinds of things, and schedule. People use them differently here. Kilometer, kilometer, there's lots of them that I can think of. These are the great Canadian debates, Ben. But you said, look, you can track it over time. So you make the argument that there has been, a larger British invasion in our language over the past couple of decades. Why do you think that's been happening?
Well, I think essentially because internet, English is one of the, if not the global languages, and there are all these people writing in all sorts of venues and platforms and publications and blogs and so forth and so on. So there's a lot of cross-pollination of the terms. The other thing is that with all this writing and all this publications and websites and blogs, writers want to be distinctive. They want to stand out. They want to be paid attention to. So they're always looking for new ways to say things, slang, internet slang, African-American English, whatever. And for an American writer, saying something is brilliant or spot on or one of these British phrases, at least for a little bit, makes them stand out and sound kind of cool or fresh. Now, there's a sell-by date on that, as the British say. Americans would say expiration date.
We'd say best before.
Best before. I like that. It's alliteration.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why we say that? Because it's not expired, the date. It's just best before that date.
So are Canadians sticklers for facts and accuracy? Interesting.
Us journalists
precision.
Try to be.
Nice. I like
if
it.
If you're just joining us and wondering what all this bloody blather about Britishism is about here on the radio, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking or chatting up Ben Yagoda, whose new book is called Gobsmacked, and it's about the British invasion of North American English. Okay, Ben, let's get into some of these noobs, these not one-off Britishisms that you've observed.
If I can mention one that you said, that's another interesting one, is chat up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, chat up, when it went from Britain, at least to the U.S., actually changed or at least developed a new meaning. In Britain, people think of it means one thing, which is to flirt or hit on somebody. To chat up a bird at the pub would be to try to, you know, make time, as they said way back in 1930s movies. But over in America, U.S., it's used as you used it, to chat with, to have a friendly conversation with somebody. And when I write about that on the blog, British people are up in arms. That's not what chat up means. You can't use it that way. That's wrong.
You also mentioned bird. My 14-year-old daughter is very angry at her male counterparts because they now call girls birds, and she finds it so offensive. And I said, yeah, I said, in England, this is what they do.
I have not run across that in the U.S. I was thinking, you know, back to the Beatles and Hard Day's Night on the birds. But I'll have my eyes out for that one over here.
Yeah, might not take off. I don't know. Let's talk about posh, because again, I think this is one of the ones someone is saying, I know what posh means. It comes from port out starboard home, which is not true, my friends. Tell me about where posh, meaning swanky or fancy, comes from.
Right. Well, you know, that idea that you brought up about port outward starboard home is this, they call it a folk etymology, that somebody way back when essentially invented, and it's not true in any way, shape, or form, but it's the etymology kind of has a life of its own. And it's the idea that, you know, forgive me, I don't remember what port is and what starboard is, but when you went on a ship voyage to the east, the rich, posh people would have the side with no sun on the way there, and then the other side on the way back. Hence, posh. But that's not the origin at all. I think what brought it increased popular in the U.S. and probably Canada was And I became aware of this when my kids were very into the Spice Girls.
Spice Girls, yes.
And Posh Spice, who wasn't really posh. It was kind of an ironic nickname that she had. She was more middle class, but she affected a kind of upper class manner. And since then, it's been quite commonly used over here.
Yeah, she's fulfilled the poshness by marrying David Beckham, and they're quite posh now.
Double posh.
Yeah. Well, and there's Ginger in the Spice Girls, too, right? Meaning redhead.
Yes, and that's another one, Ginger. Exactly. That was not here, used here in the U.S. at all 20, 30 years ago. Ginger Spice, and then probably something to do also with the Harry Potter books, where Ron Weasley was famously a ginger.
Yes.
And Prince Harry, and, you know, now commonly used on South Park and all over the place in the U.S.
Yeah, and some people find ginger offensive, if not rude, to call someone a ginger. So there you go. I said something earlier about when I went to university, and you slightly mock me and Americans who talk about going to university, because in the American context, people would say they go to college. Is this correct?
It's correct. And I, far be it from me to mock you. I think you come by it rightly, because I think it's said in Canada for sure. Right. In the U.S., it's odd. I mean, we have these institutions that are kind of the same, like it would be, I live in the town of Swarthmore, we've got Swarthmore College. Another part of the state is Penn State University, and they're both four-year institutions of higher learning, the difference being that universities have graduate schools and medical schools and law schools, and in the U.S., that's considered a university. But whether you go to Swarthmore or Penn State, an American would traditionally say, I went to college. The Britishism is when I was at university or going to university. And, you know, that's said in the rest of the English-speaking world, just not in the U.S. But as part of the not one-off Britishisms phenomenon, I've begun to hear that more and more here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So there are differences, of course, between Canadian English and American English, because, as I said, we say go to university. You're a careful watcher, Ben Yagoda, of the English language. Boy, I don't know if I want to ask you this, but I'm going to want to weigh in where Canadian English fits into all of this.
Well, you know, I'm at a bit of a disadvantage. All these resources like the Google Ngrams, they don't break out Canada. So it's a bit of guesswork on my part. And but I've talked to some colleagues and friends over there, and I've noticed, I mean, it used to be that I was able to spot a Canadian because they said organization.
What do you say?
We say, well, we used to say organization.
Oh, right, of course. Yeah.
Now, especially young people have picked up on the British and Canadian organization. So that trick doesn't work so well anymore. But it does still work with things like process and progress, which they say in Britain and Canada, but not the U.S. My sense is in Canada, they say something they don't say in the U.K., which is the word B-E-E-N, pronounced bean,
yeah,
and A-G-A-I-N, again.
Yeah.
We don't say that. I don't think the Brits say that, but Canadians say that.
Wait.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, so Americans say bin. I've been to the store.
Exactly.
Canadians, I think we say, I've been to the store, but
yes,
maybe somewhere in the middle of those two. And then again, yes, I said, we mostly say again. I'm not speaking for all 40 million of us. We are a very diverse population, but yeah.
One of the big differences I understand is changing is the last letter of the alphabet. What would you say that's called?
Oh, Ben, you're going to get me in trouble with the listeners. So I always say when I'm speaking with an American, like if I'm talking about Generation X, millennials, and then I'll say, because you're American, I'm going to say Gen Z. And someone will write in and say, but we're Canadians and it's Z. And when my children learn the alphabet at very young ages, I said, it's not Z, kids. We're Canadians. It's Z. So.
Okay. Well, a bit of a cop out, but that's okay. So my informants tell me that that's changing in Canada. And
it
similarly
is
with spelling things like check, writing a check in the U.S. would be C-H-E-C-K. Traditionally in Canada, I think C-H-E-Q-U-E, and color, C-O-L-O-U-R.
Oui, oui, monsieur. Yes.
Those are changing.
Sometimes we're trying to resist because, and that brings up the point, Ben, you've been studying language for a long time, the English language. In a globalized world, you know, there's a lot of milieu, right? But are you concerned about it all sort of, I don't want to say flattening, but it's all kind of being more similar, if not same?
I'm really not. You know, I did a little experiment. I read a book on brain science, not related to language at all, written by a professor at a university in Wales. And I read the entire book. I was interested in it. It wasn't for this little experiment. But I wrote down all the terms that were unfamiliar to me as an American that were Britishisms. And by my rough reckoning, 75 to 80% had not come over here at all. The ones I write about are notable and interesting, but they're a minority. When you go over there and you read the British press, there's still terms that have not been used in the U.S. at all. And similarly, at least half or almost half of the readers of my blog are British people, and they're amused, not to say gobsmacked, by this idea that Britishisms have come to America, because they've heard the opposite narrative, that Americanisms are polluting the pure British language. And there was an article to that effect just last week in the Telegraph. And it's pretty much poppycock, which isn't a Britishism. That's Dutch. Because, you know, they complain about people saying "you guys" and calling a biscuit a cookie. And it's just a handful of little things that have come over there and, like, ordering food, saying, "can I get a burger?"
Yeah, chips and fries and all the mix.
Right,
yeah,
the chips or fries. And in fact, if you go to London, chips are different from fries. Chips are those thick things, and fries are like the literally French fries.
Yeah.
So no, I'm not worried. It's not flattening. It's fun. Sometimes people are a little pretentious. Sometimes these things become cliches, but that's okay. That's not a hanging offense. It provides me a lot of amusement and diversion, so I'm good with it.
I want you to clarify one more thing. This actually happened just right before the start of school this year around my supper table. As you might know, as an American, the NFL season has started up. One of my kids was talking about that, and so then they asked about football and soccer. And I said, no, only in North America do we call it soccer. And my husband, who knows things that I certainly don't know, said, no, don't tell them that. That's a fib, that soccer is a North American invention. So you wrote about it, Ben. Clear up my mistake.
Well, your husband, as the British say, is clever, which means he's intelligent and he knows whereof he speaks. And in fact, soccer, these two forms of football came up in the late 1800s. One was played at the rugby school, and it was called rugger and later rugby. And the other is the one that's known now around the world as football and in the U.S. as soccer, that you don't pick up with your hands. And that was dubbed soccer because the British love to abbreviate things. So it was association football. And association became soccer. It was called soccer and football in Britain, widely both used, until fairly recently when soccer became kind of déclassé and known as what the Americans say. The Americans adopted soccer full force because their game of football, that the NFL, American football, came in. So you couldn't very well have two footballs. So they went all in with soccer. But originally, it was a British term for sure. So he was absolutely right. Spot on.
Spot on. You leave me gobsmacked, my friend. What else should we say, Ben? Should I say thank you for joining us? Cheers.
Cheers to you.
I know. I should have known that about soccer and football. I didn't. Now I do. Thank you to Ben Yagoda for all of those explanations. He is the author of Gobsmacked. All right, that is it for this week here on the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Huang, Pete Mitten, Aronde Williams, and Lou Joe. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer is Brian Colton. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you so very much for lending us your ear. Till next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.